Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Just before we get started, just a brief content warning. This conversation with Jess Hill includes discussions of domestic violence and family court practices in Australia.
This is All the President's Minutes, and I'm your host, Blake Howard. In fact, I'm the producer of all the One Heat Minute productions. First and foremost, I just wanted to reach out with my empathy and solidarity for everyone in the United States of America, the African American community, who once again are being forced to riot to be heard in the face of overwhelming and brazen police brutality. When I conceived of this show, I thought that it would be a great landing zone for conversations about cinema, about journalism, about history, and about politics and where those things intersect. The show will go on. However, just some of the episodes that you're going to hear in the coming run of episodes have occurred before any of the events over the last week have unfolded. I once again want to wish my empathy and solidarity from Australia to my American brothers and sisters and to my dear friends, and wish them safety in their protest, in their peaceful protest. And this is not unique to the United States. And any Australian who is listening has to have the morality and the fortitude to acknowledge that this lucky country that I feel guilty for continually saying that I'm lucky that I live in is built on the blood of our own First Nations peoples, and Indigenous Australians continue to suffer the same plight as African American citizens in the United States. And whether it's by agenda or legitimate legal restrictions, Australian press continue to be suffocated. And on this show, we're going to talk about it. Thank you for supporting. Thank you for listening. Let's get into the show.
So it seems like that people were very prepared.
And then we're behind the line.
Okay.
Okay, well, you keep going and go where you gotta go, and that's fine with us.
Okay.
We got plenty of time here.
Are you okay?
I'm getting shot! I'm getting...
Katie, are you okay?
Rubber bullets, it's okay. It's those pepper bullets.
Who are they aiming that at?
Now you're shooting at the photographer.
At us! Like, directly at us! Directly
Why
at us!
Why are they doing that?
They're shooting at our crew.
I don't
Do
know!
Do they not know that... Obviously, they see the camera.
Right.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Joining me today is, well, the great thing about this show is that as opposed to just film critical minds or people in the biz, we have a great eclectic bunch of journalists and satirists and historians and whatnot that get to come onto the show. And I was reading the Australian Guardian a couple of weeks ago now, or maybe even a month ago now, and I read about a book called See What You Made Me Do from an Australian investigative journalist who just won the Stellar Award for Women's Writing. And in that interview about her Stellar Award winning, now Stellar Award winning investigative document, was her describing the process as a meticulous dismantling of lazy old lies and an excavation of so many held beliefs and biases of domestic violence in Australia and the world. And that dismantling, that meticulous dismantling particularly, I thought, well, this is a person who has been on the forefront of a story that basically no one wants to hear and has then made the telling so compelling as to win an award. And what a great person that would be to talk to about on this show, like talk about journalistic dismantling and what that's like to be doing it and then to sort of at least have some kind of glory in the fact that people are responding to the book so well. So it's with my distinct pleasure to welcome Jess Hill to the show. Jess, thank you so much for being on All the President's Minutes.
My pleasure, Blake. Thanks for having me.
So now your book, See What You Made Me Do, you're like on currently on a bit of a promo trail with it, I guess, and it's just won. How you've been writing this book since 2014, it's now 2020. What is it like after so long grinding to make this book happen? What is it like being in the trenches of a story like this that essentially consumes your whole life? And how do you get out of that? How do you come out the other side?
Well, that's a good question, and one that I'd like to ask someone else. Like, you know, how do I get out of it? I'm certainly out of the trenches. It's like the difference between having a six-month-old and a three-year-old. You know, like you're still going through it, but you aren't. You know, you aren't deep in the shit anymore.
They can go to the toilet now. You know,
that's
they can
right.
They can feed themselves.
Still wipe their bottom, but you know, it's you're out of the really labor intensive part. I think that for me, that I started writing at the end of 2014, wrote and reported for that whole year of 2015, and then got commissioned to write the book. The book was supposed to be just a quick wrap of the research, you know, that I'd already done, 6 months or to do it. And then the deadline just kept on marching further and further out. But there's a big difference between taking on a book and knowing in advance that it's going to take years.
Yes.
To as opposed to taking on a book that it's going to take 6 months, and then it's going to maybe take 10 months, and then maybe 16 months, and then
yeah.
So you never feel the freedom in it. You're always feeling guilty, always feeling late. You know, it's always that you're not doing this quick enough. Why can't you get to the bottom of this? So in addition to the actual difficulty of the material was the feeling that one was always failing because I hadn't met any of the number of deadlines that, that my publisher had agreed to. But I think that for the, in the actual sort of guts of what I was writing about, you know, it would change some chapters would be a lot easier than others. You know, the children's chapter, for which I interviewed several kids between 8 and 18, but also grown adults who'd grown up with it as children. That was so difficult and so confronting, and I was writing it when I was pretty heavily pregnant. I just happened to win a writer's retreat that I'd entered and forgotten about some months before, and I got an email at like 34 weeks pregnant saying, "You've just been awarded this retreat, would you like to take it?" And it was like a week in the Dandenongs, I'm from Sydney, in this beautiful little house, and I was looking at my belly going, well, I won't be able to take it any time in the next however many years if I don't look now.
If it's not now, it's definitely not a solo trip, you know, about 34 weeks.
Yeah. Precisely. And I will be getting no writing done. And so I thought, well, look, I've just got to go now, you know, and there was much consternation and my partner was convinced I was going to give birth in some, you know, part of the mountains and that he was not going to be there. And so I ended up going there, but being there for 5 or 6 days alone and just writing at any time of day or night and sleeping at most unusual hours meant I was able to get that chapter done before I gave birth. And that was really important because I couldn't have been in the lives of those children having just had a newborn baby. It just wasn't going to work. So
yeah.
There was so much like that. It was such an odyssey. I can't tell you, like, it's almost like the book at the end of it is a product of that, but the actual journey of writing it was such a thing in itself. You know, this is why we have movies like All the President's Men, where the actual background of producing something, a long investigation, can be more tumultuous than the investigation sort of betrays. And that was certainly the case for me. It was a incredibly disturbing, poignant, transcendent, burdensome project that utterly changed my life.
You get to the end, and at least the luxury of doing a project like this, like All the President's Minutes, looking at this film, is that hindsight's beautiful when you get to condense 3 or 4 or like ongoing years of work into a reflective, punchy, you know, sort of docudrama. It's very nice. But when you're going through it literally and battling through, you know, beautiful things like being pregnant at the same time and having babies and all that sort of stuff, I think it's unimaginable, but it's extremely commendable. And I think, you know, I'm from Sydney too. Escaping to the Dandenongs to write and be there both sounds like a reprieve and sounds like a great accelerator, but it also sounds like an isolation. You know, we're speaking of our current isolation now. It's like you're in ISO with those kids and those stories, which there'll be links to it in the description of the podcast and whatever podcast app you're doing, and on our site oneheatminute.com when you want to check out the post of the actual episode, so you can jump off and check that out for Jess. But yeah, it's a really powerful and compelling thing, and now something also while we're in this crisis that seems to be rearing its head in a big bad way.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, it's been curious because I've been really tracking it around the world from what we can, you know, garner from police report statistics or from what frontline services are saying. And so, you know, we have statistics that vary from China, that there was a doubling or tripling in reports in some areas, especially where the lockdown was particularly severe.
Yeah.
And in the UK, there has been, in the weeks since they locked down, a more than doubling of the domestic homicide rate. In various other places, Singapore, Cyprus, you know, helpline calls are up by a third. Here in Australia, what is interesting is that we see frontline services say that the need for their services has increased, but also the complexity of what they're dealing with has increased. But then the police statistics are different. Some of them show an increase in reports in some areas, others show a decrease. They say across the board the rate is stable. In New South Wales, the domestic homicide rate is actually far lower than it was at this time last year. And there are multiple different reasons for that that I think we won't become clear until after this is over, but that include, you know, a bit more of proactive action from police in terms of visiting high-risk perpetrators, enforcing orders. The number of breaches of intervention orders have gone up, which doesn't mean that perpetrators are breaching more often. It means that police are enforcing the breaches, which is a constant problem. In that, you know, often perpetrators will breach an intervention order that says you can't be in contact or make threats of violence, etc., and they will, you know, be sending threatening text messages or lurking about outside somebody's house, and police just won't enforce the breach. And so it makes those intervention orders sort of not worth the paper they're written on when you can't enforce them. So right now we're seeing a much better rate of enforcement. It's like the domestic violence sector, when the lockdown started, they sent up the red flare and were like, this is a incredibly dangerous situation and everybody needs to be all hands on deck to really respond to any sign of a increase of greater danger, etc. And I feel like there has been a good response to that. And even just the reasonably generous wage subsidies that have not gone to everyone, but have gone to a part of the population who would otherwise be humiliated, struggling. You know, that's the sort of stuff that feeds violence and feeds abuse in households. And when you kind of offset that by having the government come in and providing, it means that you are interrupting a lot of what I think would be the worst kinds of violence, or at least the worst kinds of physical violence. So, you know, it's very hard to say. I think obviously we're seeing that in those households where the state is not sort of being called in and where no one is calling anyone for help, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that these conditions would increase the risk. But we're not actually seeing, thank God, a rise in domestic homicides, as far as I can note.
Yeah, one final thing just before we jump to much lighter topics of this movie. I think one of the things that your book shook me up, and maybe it's coincided since I read the article and since I sort of preliminarily reached out to you about coming onto the show, is your book dispelled for me I think you put it best as sort of like a sort of dunderheaded, like stupid, you know, thought in my head, or like a presumption that domestic violence happens in, like, it's a, you know, being passed through a family, like it's a genetic defect or something like that. Like if you've been touched by it, you're more likely to, you know, to touch others with it, etc. But I think what your book struck me with, and now in conjunction with COVID, and it's, you know, so fascinating and insightful to hear you sort of unpack it for the people that are listening to the show, is that it's a whole, like, it is a myriad of factors that are sort of like this, that create an alchemy and that are like a recipe for disaster. So, you know, like exactly as you just outlined, and you outline it so well in your book, it's like, you know, job losses and, you know, the lack of socialization and, you know, different sort of levels of humiliation that are happening in the workplace that come home, and even the, you know, sort of safer workplaces, people bringing home, not being able to react in an emotional way back home where they can in the privacy of their own home, but that's a dangerous thing. You know, it's a really fascinating thing. And I think that's, you know, at least in, you know, we can, you know, probably say more safely and with more certainty in our own country, but at least the dialogue around domestic violence and reaching out and not being ashamed to ask for help, and at least the dialogue from the people in power in this country has been around, you know, what, keeping watch of domestic violence and keeping it on people's radar and keeping it not a thing of shame but a thing of awareness that we need to sort of support, has been really, really good during this crisis in my mind as an outsider.
And, you know, it's also around the immature expectations that that are really drummed into a lot of boys and that follow them into manhood about what a relationship should be, how they should feel in a relationship, what they should expect.
Yes.
You know, and what happens very early in boyhood, where they're, it's not so much just like don't cry. It's not about not being able to cry. It's about almost training boys to feel allergic to vulnerability, to feel like any sense of being seen to be out of control, or being seen to not know what you're doing, or just, you know, being vulnerable is very threatening. And so when there's no area of our life that is more prone to vulnerability than intimate relationships. You know, that's where our vulnerabilities are fleshed out, and we are the best and worst parts of ourselves.
That's where that's where your shields are down, Jess. You know,
required. You know, that's the thing, is what's required of you to have intimacy is vulnerability. And so it's like we have raised boys and men to be utterly unable to be in intimate relationship. And I'm not talking about obviously all boys and men. You know, obviously there are lots of boys and men out there who have resisted that training or have become aware of how those feelings move about in themselves and have confronted them and tried to work with them and overcome them. Any number of reactions there, but the dominant culture, you know, says to men that you need to be in control. And if you're not in control, then you'll end up losing out. You won't get the girl because all the women want guys who are in control and autonomous and logical and unemotional. And you won't get the money because, you know, the business world is all dog eat dog, and kill or be killed. It's just like it's a deforming kind of influence. And so it's no wonder that we see deformed behavior in the home. And that doesn't even go into the individual circumstances of whether you've grown up in a traumatic household or whether you've been shamed as a child or whether you've been rejected. All those things obviously play into it as well. But it just feminists have been saying for a really long time, look at the society that we've built. Look at, you know, European patriarchy and what it drums into young boys. Are you that surprised that you see this level of violence occurring in the home?
Yes. It's actually in this very era of at least American cinema where you start to see the shift from this mask, this facade of strong, silent type, into guys like Dustin Hoffman, who ply his wares as an actor in a career as deeply vulnerable, flawed, emotionally all over the shop people. Exactly. And so you've got these really different portrayals of masculinity coming through in cinema, and that's that, you know, and eventually it comes back around in the 80s where you talk about it from a purely like how it reflects in culture, like remasculinization. So, you know, Reagan comes back in power in the 80s, you know, post Nixon, you know, through Nixon, Watergate, you know, post JFK, you get this sort of vulnerability, this, you know, different queer characters, all that sort of stuff. And then you get to the 80s and it's like Stallone and Schwarzenegger and Jean-Claude Van Damme and all these chiseled bodies like trying to get revenge for Vietnam. And it's like, oh, we're just going back. Because the patriarchal cycle means that we can't. We have to be impervious. We can't allow our vulnerability in there.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, it's a great book called Backlash by Susan Faludi, and it looks at how what we started to see through the second wave of feminism through the 70s, where women were, you know, divorcing their abusive husbands, they were wanting their own careers, and single motherhood was becoming, much more common, and single mothers with careers, which was like, you know, devil's spawn. And you start to see, especially in Hollywood, like, you know, movies like Fatal Attraction, where one of the lead protagonists, Glenn Close's character, who's stalking this man. It's like she's this single career woman who wants to invade this man's family and displace the humble wife who, you know, plot spoiler, but ends up killing her in the, you know, ultimate triumph of the patriarchal female. and it's amazing. I really wanted to include this story in the book, but that movie, Fatal Attraction, the original synopsis for that movie was about a man who cheats on his wife, who gets found out and has to basically like fess up to what he's done, and has to be held accountable. It wasn't about some crazy female stalker, but it got, once it was in the hands of, I think it was Adrian Lyne, was the director, once it was in Adrian Lyne's hands, and you hear him talk about it, and you even hear Michael Douglas talk about it, who was also in the film, and they are reveling in taking down that independent, powerful female character. And even in...
And they have to, but they have to make her a bunny boiler, right? Like she can't just be a regular human person. She can't be a human person. She's got to be a witch.
They have to make her insane. And in cinemas across America, when that have, you know, when Fatal Attraction was playing, you'd have audiences at the end when the wife was sort of coming to kill Glenn Close, and they'd be saying, kill the bitch, like screaming at the screen, you know. And it's like, that's the thing, that's the backlash, that's going like, nope, we've had enough of this, we've got to shut it down, and so we've got to demonize this woman, And that really lasted in the culture until quite recently.
Yeah, it's you know, like you said in the preface of your book, it's 2014 is the watershed year for sort of new wave feminism and finally voices being heard, and it was this tsunami, I think, mm-hmm. and then social media like harnessed to that full power, and so since then it started to really, you know, in a variety of ways gain momentum and push the dialogue and conversation and start to sort of shake those biases down to the very foundations. And it's like, you know, especially in other countries, in Oz there's still some hiccups, which is why, you know, someone like you is so invaluable in this dialogue, but in other countries you've seen big people get, yeah, getting taken down. And I was speaking earlier to the great New York Times film critic Manola Dargis on this show, and our episode of All the President's Minutes was actually interrupted because the news broke that Harvey Weinstein was actually arrested, like that was convicted of a crime. And so we had to end our episode prematurely because Manola, you know, working for the New York Times, was sort of called into action to that breaking story. So yeah, I think it's now taking some time and momentum, and people are being held accountable and all those sorts of things. And it's starting to make an impact, and people are starting to pause.
Yeah, totally. And you know, the Me Too movement had a really significant impact on the way that I wrote the book. I would not have titled a chapter Patriarchy, and I probably wouldn't have investigated the nature of patriarchy and its impacts on how we socialize and everything of how we interact with the world had it not been for that movement. Because prior to Me Too, right up until then, patriarchy was still seen as some radical femo word that was, you know, that showed you up as a man hater. And I thought that if I really interrogate this term, I'm going to alienate a whole section of the readership that I really want to engage with. But by the time Me Too came along, you know, patriarchy was just like common parlance at dinner parties and water cooler conversations. And you know, it's why I end the book at first quite, you know, I was a bit cautious and a bit concerned about how people might respond ending a book about domestic abuse with someone like Steve Bannon. But what I say at the end there is that, you know, if you don't believe it's possible to reduce domestic abuse now, consider that 5 years ago, few could have imagined something like Me Too that's not just become a revolution against sexual harassment, but against patriarchy itself. And, you know, that even that disheveled alt-right culture warrior, Steve Bannon, who is a booster for fascists and white supremacists, acknowledges it as the most radical movement of our time. And he said this thing to a Bloomberg reporter, which I found amazing, because as much as I despise Steve Bannon and everything he stands for, he does have a pretty keen eye for where the culture is going. And he said to them, you know, time's up on 10,000 years of recorded history. This is coming. This is real. And it is real. And, you know, that's why people are kicking back really strong. And it's again, you know, we're having that battle, but it's like more people have come over to a place of understanding with Me Too than came over in the 1970s.
Yeah. It's, you know, that constant, you know, serve and volley of progress, right? Like it's like that there'll be progress, and then there's the reflective volley against it, and then back and forth. And you've seen the pushback already with Me Too, but I think the momentum is just trudging along, and it's and at the moment, despite the impediments, it seems to be going forward. Well, look, and also I love that we've kind of sort of brought it back to politics, because you're right about Steve Bannon. He does have his finger on the pulse, even though he's an absolute lunatic and a pig and he's disgusting. So from one portrayal of a disgusting man to someone who is not disgusting, someone who is good, Dustin Hoffman. In this moment, in this performance is Carl Bernstein and the incredible Ned Beatty playing Mr. Dardis here. Let's dive back into the minute that we're talking about. So guys, we will dive into just watching the minute right now, and then Jess and I will come back and unpack it for you.
It's going to have to wait until tomorrow, okay?
Well, I just wish you could have told me that before I left, because I got to go back to my paper now and write that story one way or another, that's all.
you want to see Mr. Barker's phone records and his money records?
You told me on the telephone when I came down and you showed me everything he got on Barker. That's all I want.
Well, that's what I've got.
Well, that's fine.
Okay, you and I are going to have an agreement that you're not going to reveal the source of your information. All these are cashier's checks on a bank in Mexico City.
All these checks from Mexico?
You see?
How come? Did money originate there?
Well, I doubt it started off as pesos.
Well, wait a minute, what's this one?
Okay, $25,000,
Was that Kenneth?
Kenneth H. Dahlberg. We haven't been able to ascertain who that is.
Bob, listen, I think I got something. I don't know what it is. But somewhere in this world, there is a Kenneth H. Dahlberg, and we got to get to him before the New York Times does. Because I think they have the same information. You got a pencil? Write this down.
There it is. I do love one line. I love one call and response so much in this 60 seconds of 1976 masterpiece, All the President's Men, Jess, which is, all I want is everything. And Dardis in Ned Beatty's just beautiful sort of casual, well, that's what I've got. Like, you know, it's all I want is everything. Well, I've got everything. So it's yours. And there's just this sort of glum, little bit of self-satisfaction from Dustin Hoffman's Carl Bernstein, sort of smugly smiling that he's kind of got what he needs. But for you and I watching, taking it now to this film, apart from now being an investigative journalist and author, you're a producer on the ABC for a radio producer, a news producer. How much has, and I think it might be good to talk to you as an Aussie journo, like this movie that lionizes journalists, is this a movie that's seminal for Aussie journalists? Was it a part of your life? Was it something that you sort of consumed, other than the obviousness and the sort of omnipresence of the word Watergate and adding the suffix gate to everything? Like, is this a movie that you like, you've revisited, you're into?
I did, I've watched it a few years ago, but, in terms of, like, I'm not with the ABC now, but I was for several years and worked in the, PM World Today and AM team. The thing was that Bob Woodward, by the time I was working in journalism, he'd sort of crossed over to being, I'm sorry, Bob, but a little bit of a White House hack. He wasn't in his glory days anymore. I joined the ABC just after the election of Obama. But Bob Woodward, from memory, he'd written a book sort of from inside the Bush White House, and it was pretty fawning. So for me, he sort of I'm not comparing him in terms of content, but in this, like John Pilger, for me, when I was a baby journalist and sort of looking up to other journalists.
Tell folks, because I know very familiar with John and his work and especially his documentaries. Can you just explain to international listeners, just give a little bit more context on who John Pilger is, just in case they might not know if it's an international listener?
So John Pilger, great foreign correspondent, did a lot of work in Vietnam, really, and, back then reporting the other side of the story. His career has been pretty, has been about really busting US imperialism, largely, and imperialism generally, and not about reporting from the position of Western power, as I guess, quite a few journalists have, even foreign correspondents who've tried to hold the line and challenge power. He has been quite unique in his challenging of that. The thing is, I think, with John Pilger is that over the years he became more egotistical, kind of embittered, more hubristic. And I think actually his work is still quite good. Utopia, I think The War We Don't See, which was about, how the BBC does or doesn't cover issues in Palestine.
Yes.
I actually really enjoyed those, and I think they were up to scratch with his earlier work, but his attitude and the way that he's sort of come to represent a more conspiratorially minded journalist, That's been a real shame. Especially, when the Syrian war started, we started to see a real like drawing of lines. So people like Robert Fisk, the great Middle East correspondent, who had put, you know, largely in the same category as John Pilger.
Yes.
Started to report in ways that were confusingly pro-Assad. And what started to see was sort of like anyone who is the enemy of Israel and America is my friend type of thing. And Robert Fisk did some pretty horrific PR reports for the Assad government. I was in Lebanon when the war was in its early phases, and Robert Fisk lives in Beirut, and it was, you know, it was a real topic of conversation among Middle East journalists, how far he'd fallen in their estimation. And John Pilger also became a booster for Assad. And, you know, I'm sorry if I'm verballing you, John, but from what I had read, it was sort of, you know, really talking about false flag incidents where it couldn't have been possible that Assad would have launched a chemical weapons attack on an outlying suburb of Damascus, or, it, you know, that it must have been the rebels, or it must have been America, or it was Russia, or, you know, it's sort of, yeah, John Pilger sort of gone across to that Russia Today type of perspective. And it's a real shame, because I think, you know, I used to look up to him a lot, and it's made it very difficult for him to engage with the mainstream, which is probably fine by him. So for me, you know, for me, people like that and Bob Woodward to a lesser extent, but it sort of had become like access was more important to him than holding political figures really to account.
Yes.
And obviously that was a bit different in his account of the Trump White House, but, you know, like the fact was he had so many people willing to talk that access wasn't an issue. And his book on the Trump White House was fated, and it seems rightly so. But I actually, right at the end of my time at the ABC, I did a fellowship with the Edward R. Murrow Fellowship to the States.
Wow.
And it's a fellowship that's given out to people all over the world. So there's representatives, journalistic representatives from all over the world. And we all sort of tour the States, and we start in Washington, D.C., and there's lectures at the State Department, and, you know, it's a really incredible opportunity to not only have access to the various arms of the U.S. government, but also to see what it's like for journalists in some of the hardest regions to report from. And we were at the U.S. State Department, and I was there with a bunch of journalists from all over, but from China, but especially from Pakistan and from Afghanistan. And Bob Woodward was giving the guest lecture. And people, I mean, like as soon as he came in the room, everyone was just all over him. Everyone wanted a photo. He was being totally mobbed. In fact, it was just impossible to get anywhere near him. And he gave his address, and he's talking. As he was talking and talking about access to power and talking about Watergate, he had a message for the reporters in the room who may find it hard to get people in power to answer their questions. And he said to this room full of people from countries like Pakistan and Afghanistan that if you cannot get the people in power to answer your questions, well, then you just march straight up to their door. You go to their homes, march straight up to their door in the middle of the night if you have to. You knock on that door, and when they answer, you say, "I demand to know the truth." And I'm just looking around going, Bob, do you know what it's like to report on politicians in Afghanistan and Pakistan? And afterwards, you know, after he'd gone and everyone gave him a hearty round of applause, the Pakistani journalists were all huddled together. I went over and said, "What do you think?" And he said, "Yeah, well, we're just thinking about what would you say to all those men with the AK-47s when you marched up to the front door
of at,
the
midnight. At midnight. At midnight. In the Pakistani mountains, or in a huge palatial gated community that has 12 security guards on a 24-hour rotating circle. Yeah, look, it's...
They love that. They love being surprised by reporters in the middle of the night. Oh, and then they do invariably tell you the truth when you get to their front door.
Yeah, it's really funny. It's really funny that, you know, it's really funny how antithetical that is to the grind that is portrayed in this movie and the grind of their true to life story. Like the grind of, they had 300, not just people in power, people who just were in the know, who were following orders from people in power and slamming doors in their face continuously for months.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was something else that Bob Wood said, can you imagine anything more terrifying than being asked by a source to go down into the basement of a car park at night? And, you know, there's people.
A lot of people in that room that
are like, yeah, I can imagine lots more terrifying things than that.
Bob, let me tell you.
Being shot at, you know?
Bob, have you heard of a landmine? Okay. That's. Yeah. That's.
Have you heard of the Taliban? You know, it just was so funny because I think what, you know, what it sort of revealed to me was that here's someone who is a legend and will always be a legend in journalism. And he did have to totally do all the old school journalism tricks to land the biggest investigation that we've practically ever seen, against all odds. But here's someone who for a long time has been fated and has had incredible privilege and access and can't remember what it was like, you know, and how, and actually how dangerous it was. And that back in those days, access to politicians, you didn't have a million media minders around them, let alone the guys with the AK-47s, you know, in the Northwest frontier. But like, you didn't have this coterie of people preventing you from accessing, you know, you really could go to someone's house and possibly get them to answer the door. Whereas now, even the most sort of middling politicians, it can be very difficult to get access to them, you know. And I mean, I'm, you know, in Australia it might be a different story, but it's like there's a very different world that journalists occupy now than the one that Bob Woodward did back then. Even then, it was difficult.
And the this film, as a text, and this story, like the how this story broke and the reporting around it, in essence, incentivizes and creates this huge industry around politicians as protectors, like PR people who just, you know, media advisors, whatever the case may be, that are the intermediaries and the buffers that play between journalists such as yourself and them. Mm. So when you're trying to penetrate, it's not just using a really crafty trick and calling them at their holiday home that you've somehow got a number for and getting lucky, because that obviously can still happen, or like you call a hotel where you know they're staying, or, you know, there are all those tricks that can still happen in the modern, in a contemporary sense. But then there is the PR manager, the agent, the, you know, the media manager.
Are they going to talk to you?
Are they even going to have a conversation on the record? Like, and in Australia, for folks in America who are listening, the concept of on or off the record in Oz, from what I've heard from my journalistic friends, is like, we don't have the same. There's not, you might have a source who's willing to go off the record, but if you're talking to a politician and they agree to talk to you and you're from a major news publication in this country, they kind of know that the minute you walk in the door, they're on the record. Like, there's a presumption of anything they say will be used against them, so to speak. So
unless they say this is all off the record.
Unless really clearly, yeah, I will only talk to you if this is off the record. Yeah. So it's just one of those really strange things. But I think it's
why we always have unnamed sources, you know, peppering all of these political articles and, you know, trying to dob on their colleagues, or, you know, or stir up unrest in their party. It's like very rare that you get someone going actually on the record with their name.
And in Australia, it's a different kettle of fish too. You know, it's a different kettle of fish from our libel laws and things like that. You know, there's a whole other thing in a recent episode that folks will be listening to now. I was speaking to one of my, you know, a film critical mind colleague of mine and friend, Niall Schwartz, and he was asking about, you know, why someone like myself, a film critic in Australia, would be wanting to talk about this story, about like, does it have a universal appeal being such a quintessentially American story? And I said, yeah, because of the omnipresence of the thing. And in Australia particularly, we've got journalists such as yourself who like have to tirelessly work to get breaks into, you know, government organizations to have the information revealed so that you can break big stories and then ultimately turn them into what you've done. There is a participation that...
Yeah, I mean, and not to mention the fact that, you know, whistleblowers are receiving some of the harshest punishments. You know, have yes. Richard Boyle, who was the whistleblower at the taxation office, and, you know, he was facing like 100-something years in prison
yes.
for blowing the whistle on a practice that was absolutely unethical, you know, and that is, there is absolutely no question that it was in the public interest. But, you know, and the extent to which we have changed laws to allow metadata to be tracked, and so, you know, the fact that even though they won't necessarily track a journalist's phone, by looking at the phone records of anyone that they suspect within a workplace or a public department, that they can pretty much draw, you know, whether those people have been in touch with journalists, and such to the point where they can even, I mean, there was a guy who used a public telephone that was reasonably nearby his house, or his workplace, sorry, and called a reporter about a particular story. He was a government employee, and he ended up being found out. You know, so it's like, it's very difficult now to release information unless you do it in a very old school way, literally either just absolutely in person, sending handwritten letters, things that have never touched software.
Yeah, one of the most recent episodes that just dropped, I spoke to the senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan from the ABC, and he said literally after the Australian Federal Police raids on the ABC at the end of last year, you know, and early this year, you know, talking to different sources has meant occasionally if you want to blow the whistle, don't even photocopy it, don't print it at work, maybe handwrite what you want to blow the whistle on and then mail it to a location that I can, you know, pick it up. You know, there's those sorts of things where you just,
how do you even make that contact first? Yeah. You know, do you just, because how do you get inside the ABC? You used to be able to get in and just walk in the front door, and anyone had access to a reasonable, you know, extent. You could then go to the front desk and ask to speak to a reporter, or, you know, yes. But you can't even get inside the door now.
Yes.
You know, it's like you have to have, you have to be allowed in, you have to have a reason to be there. So it's very, very difficult. And obviously there are encrypted apps like Signal and a bunch of others that you can use to contact reporters, and that are probably reasonably safe. And that is certainly, I know what some reporters use. I've even had people who are involved in family court disputes who have had gag orders in their final parenting orders, who have wanted to contact me via Signal so that nothing can be traced or brought against them in court.
Yes.
So obviously, you know, there are ways to do it, but it's just increasingly difficult, and it is a massive deterrent.
And just like in this moment that we're watching, this minute that we're talking about, there's a Florida-based political entity is trying to use Watergate as a mechanism to be re-elected, and they stumble onto a bunch of misappropriated funds that are coming internationally, looking like being laundered through there. And in this case, it's just, you know, they're literally dealing with a paper trail, a physical pieces of paper, photocopies of checks in a safe. And at that time, they, you know, it's that analog is very lovely. And the government is not at this time in 1970, 73, 74, not tapping every payphone like perhaps they are now, and sending that off to,
that's right,
sending that back off to Washington.
Not being able to trace it in the same way, or not even it not being legal to do that,
yes,
necessarily. And I guess the number of powers that our home affairs officers or homeland security officers have accrued in the decades since has allowed for, you know, much greater surveillance of reporters and their sources. So yeah, I mean, it's obviously it's not that an investigation the scale of Watergate couldn't happen now, but it is much more difficult to access all of that information. But yeah, maybe in the States there's still a bit more freedom. I remember the New York Times, the head of the New York Times Bureau in Australia said that aside from, you know, developing countries, he's reported from, Australia is the most private and the most sort of locked off first world country he's ever reported from. And it is true. It's so difficult to get access here. It's just everything is so private. People won't give you the information, and even about stuff that seems just so innocuous. But it's, you know, everything feels very locked down.
How did you overcome that, knowing the sensitivity of what you were dealing with? Because, you know, obviously there was, you know, Royal Commission and discussions, and then you're partnering with these government agencies. But like, was your reporting that was happening at the time, did that help to, was that in collaboration? Was that in support? Was that in, how did that work? Because I think that that's one major thing here, like in a sort of funny way, in what ends up being sort of a more humorous scene about personality and style when it comes to Dustin Hoffman's reporting as Carl Bernstein, you know, style, like manipulating this guy, pushing him, saying he's going to print the story one way or the other. And whereas in some of the reporting you're doing, because of the sensitivity of it, you're having to like, if you don't have that partnership, if you don't establish that relationship, then it's impossible to tell the story as effectively and as essentially as what you've done.
Yeah, I think that, you know, for me, it was like, it wasn't so much about getting information out of gatekeepers. It was more about getting people to talk frankly. So everyone from family court judges to, you know, expert witnesses who were writing psychiatric assessments of families. And one particular expert witness who had written thousands of assessments for the family court, sort of advising on whether domestic abuse was an issue or child abuse was an issue, and advising the judge on how they should allocate custody. You know, I had heard from a number of parents that this one particular psychiatrist had minimized and dismissed reports of abuse in their own family assessments, and had made recommendations to the judge that ended up putting their children in dangerous situations. And I just thought, look, I'll see if this person wants to talk to me. And I didn't do so disingenuously. I didn't approach him disingenuously. I said quite honestly that I really wanted to ask him questions about how he does his assessments and how he comes to his conclusions about these families that are often in high conflict. And what I did was, when I got in front of him, I guess was trying to pander to his ego by being impressed by what he was telling me and encouraging him to share more and more. So it made him loosen up and think that this is a friendly audience. This is someone who is legitimately interested in how I come to these conclusions. So I'll give them sort of a backstage view. And so the sorts of things he was telling me was that he would, in some cases where there was abuse allegations, he would bring the child who had made the abuse allegation into the room with the parent they'd made the abuse allegation against.
Oh, gosh.
And ask the child in front of that parent about the abuse, just to see what happens. and that he would then judge whether there was awkwardness or whether there was a tension between the two, as to judge whether the abuse had or had not occurred, which is actually, it's a horrific thing to do from the perspective of child protection. But B, it's not even an effective way to measure whether abuse has happened, because children who've experienced sexual or physical abuse can actually idealize that parent for some time, and there can be all sorts of different relationships that go on between children and parents and different sorts of behaviors. So there's absolutely no test that you can put on that sort of situation. So there was things like that I was able to get him to be really open about. That was the sort of reporting, you know, and getting like the one of the senior judges from the family court to talk about whether they have minimum standards for the people who are making these expert assessments. Do they actually need to have any expertise in child abuse or family violence? And getting that judge to sort of to get into almost a state of conflict with me, as though what I was asking was just absurd. You know, just getting in front of them and getting them to go on the record and getting them into that moment where they have to say either way, or reveal what they actually think about these things. That was the hardest thing. And that required sort of just a bit of creative thinking. But I've never been in favor of approaching a source, no matter how, no matter what that source has allegedly done or what you're trying to find out, disingenuously, like by saying, I only want to know this, when actually you want to know something completely different, and then you totally confront them in the moment and do the interview totally differently to how you promised you would. I don't like that. And I know that there are some journalists that have been accused of that in recent years in Australia. I don't think that's fair. And I'm always of the opinion that you put the best and the worst of what you hear from these people, no matter what your opinion is, because you've got to make it fair.
Yes.
So
especially if they're
government documents, it was, you know, sometimes.
Oh no, I was just going to say, Jess, especially if they're being open. So, you know, with you, like it's getting the documents and it's part of it, but for having that cooperation, for them to actually be candid and you hear things that maybe dispel some of your preconceived notions or things that, you know, shake you to your very core and sort of realize your worst fears. It's just being able to present that in an even-handed way, factually, about, you know, everything, what's and all. This is what it is.
That's precisely, yeah, that's right. And giving people the respect, you know, to say that we are all at various points the best and worst parts of ourselves. So I'm going to show people the best and worst parts of what you've shown me. I feel like at that stage, you know, then people can make up their own minds. And that's not to say that I don't give people an indication of my assessment of that person and their behavior, because, you know, I think it is important to give listeners, readers, an idea of where you fall, having done the research on how this person has behaved. But it's just, you know, objectivity is one of those words that's been, that's become really conflicted in journalistic circles as to whether it means totally impartial and therefore, you know, both just a both sides kind of argument, or whether it means, you know, actually presenting an equal and fair report. What I think, you know, after really wrestling with the notion of objectivity and what that means for reporting in various spaces, especially domestic violence, has been that in the end, what you need to be is fair, because in a lot of these situations, you know, child sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, etc., being impartial is impossible. You know, in a lot of these situations, you are kind of advocating for the victims that you're interviewing. But you must always be fair to anybody who you're trying to hold to account. That's sort of where I've fallen on it.
Jess, it's been absolutely fascinating to talk to you, and thank you for taking a digression from purely talking about your text to actually talking about the state of journalism in comparison. And that Woodward story is an all-timer, so I appreciate it very much coming down on the show. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And, you know, and I just hope that more and more folk continue to sort of consume your book and it gets that wider recognition that it fully deserves. But I just want to say I'm really appreciative of your time again. And for everyone out there, See What You Made Me Do, available everywhere. Best way to grab it, I've grabbed it on Kindle myself, but you can buy it in bookstores, hardcover, paperback, wherever, in any way, shape or form. It's a tough read for the right reasons, because it's so forthright. But I appreciate your time very much.
Thanks so much, Blake.
That was my incredible guest, Jess Hill. Wow, just an incredible journalist, an incredible voice, and an impassioned one. And now listening to that back in the wake of our discussion now a couple of weeks ago, so incredibly timely that the journalism that we're seeing on display in this movie is not the journalism that international journalists and now local journalists in the United States and journalists all over the world are experiencing in the face of authoritarian activities and violence from police. Really incredibly timely. Thank you so much for listening to All the President's Minutes. We're going to be back 4 episodes a week for the show for the foreseeable future. Miami Nice is taking a short hiatus, but Increment Vice, if you're listening to this today, we'll be back next week. OneHeatMinute.com, at Increment Vice, and at ATPM Pod on Twitter is where you can find us. I'm Blake Howard, at OneBlakeMinute, if you want to reach out. Thank you so much again for listening. Catch you in another episode soon.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.